KQED.
This is Forum. I'm John Sepulveda and from Michael Krasny. We're talking about what the campfire has revealed about the state of rural California. We're joined by April Glazer of Slate and Michelle Wiley of KQED. And you can call us. We're going to take calls for the next 10 minutes. That number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. We're going to go now to Peter in San Francisco. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Yes, hi. Thanks for your reporting. But this seems to me more not so much like a disaster where maybe 100 people or 200 or even a large number. This is 20,000 people without homes and with jobs and civil authorities affected severely. And where's the money going to come from police and so on? So it seems to me more like a war situation. And I think it needs to be found out by you, perhaps, who is responsible for this. Are there civil defense authorities, military authorities? What would this be like if it were a war? And what have other places done, you know, when they firebombed German cities and other ways in which major disruptions of economies and homes would happen? What did they do then?
This may have war-like outcomes, but I want to remind everyone that this is a civilian tragedy and that we have strict rules about how the military can be deployed. That being said, we did see MPs there. We have seen National Guard units. At the end of the day, April, this the ultimate, because of the size and scope of it and the presidential declaration, this belongs to FEMA at the end of the day.
Yeah, it does. It does. And we're not sure when FEMA is going to show up again. I have heard that they are supposed to show up soon with some kind of provisional housing. But yeah, the National Guard is out. Military police are out at checkpoints. It does feel like a war zone, but this is not a war.
Leticia from Fairfield joins us on the phone. And Leticia, you're telling us that you found a way to adopt a fire family. Tell us about that.
That's correct. There are a few different ways if you search to do so. And our family, we met yesterday. They are a couple from Paradise that ran from their house when the fire was down the street. There was no notification whatsoever. The bank where the husband was working burned to the ground. The wife is undergoing ongoing care for a spinal injury. We've taken them in, but she can't get up our stairs to our guest room. So they are staying at a local hotel. They're trying to create a life here in Fairfield. And we should all do this. We got to help each other.
You're right about that, Leticia. First of all, I want to thank you for helping out other Californians. I hope more who can help, who have the ability to help, are able to help as well. And Leticia, thank you for sharing your story. I wish the best to you and them, especially this Thanksgiving holiday. Thank you. Well, we're going to go now to TC in Palo Alto. TC, very briefly, you think this has something to do with banning campfires?
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, at the very least, since this may have been started by a campfire, a few things. In the dry season.
No, you know what, TC, I'm going to have to let you go and not out of rudeness, just because that information is not correct. The reason it's being called the campfire is because of the location and how it was named at the beginning. It didn't have anything to do with a campfire, but I appreciate that. And I encourage everyone to get educated by going to kqed.org. We're going to go to Shannon now in Lake County. Shannon, share your story.
Well, I'm obviously far from the fire in the direct sense, but I've been through two evacuations from the Valley Fire and the Mendocino Complex. Lake County is half burned. It's a very poor rural county. And I'm not blaming anybody, but the resources are not there, even in basic information. During the Valley Fire, which came very close here, I called the official information number too many times to count. I got a scripted response from a very nice young man saying, I'm sorry, I don't have any information about that. I was with my daughter in Placerville. I walked into the house to find KQED was just announcing that my area could be repopulated. It was astonishing. KQED had so much more information. I jumped in my car and came back and found, yes, my house was still standing.
I'm glad to hear that.
I think it, you know, yeah, thank you. It gets extremely tense. Like, okay, what's going to happen next year?
Right. Shannon, I'm going to let you, I'm not trying to be rude or dismiss your experience. We are just literally running out of time, so I'm going to leave it there because we got very much what you're saying. First of all, I am so glad your house is still standing, and I am unhappy to hear, as everyone who has to live at Michelle Wiley, that this bad information, I know both you and April have some thoughts on this as we bring this segment to a close. Michelle Wiley.
Sure. I think, yeah, it's hard to get information out in these situations, but there have been so many fires now in California, even just this year. I mean, we brought up the Mendocino Complex fire. There's some basic information that should be out to everyone. And I've heard time and time again talking to people, they didn't receive evacuation warnings, and it should be found out why.
Yeah, absolutely. April?
Yeah, a number of people told me that one of their chief complaints was that they didn't know this was coming and they didn't get any sort of warning. You know, they said when a child is missing, there's an Amber Alert. They didn't get a phone call.
Right.
Some people did tell me that the day before, PG&E did do a series of robocalls wherein they said, we might turn your power lines off because there's a fear of a fire because of high winds.
I didn't know that.
I did hear that from a number of people, that those robocalls were received. But then they said the power lines weren't turned off and that if they were, then that probably would have prevented the fire. So the lack of information has been a central theme throughout all my reporting.
And I want to make it really clear to our listeners, we're not saying that we know whether PG&E causes fire or not. There are questions around that. But again, we're going to wait and find, let people do their due diligence. Slate's April Glazer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And KQED's Michelle Wiley, not only thank you for joining us, but thank you for putting up with me this weekend. I know it was tough for you, Michelle Wiley.
No problem.
We're going to go to hate crimes in just a moment, talk about the rise of them according to FBI statistics. Stay with us for that segment. Welcome back to Forum. I'm John Sepulvedo in for Michael Krasny. Hate crimes rose 17% in 2017, with anti-Semitic crimes increasing by 37%, according to a new FBI report. While statistics can help highlight a disturbing upward trend, they cannot capture the stories or the voices of the victims. Activist and lawyer Arjun Singh Sethi's new book, American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, recenters the conversation around those most impacted by hate crimes, and he joins us now. Arjun, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about what you found in your book, American Hate. How did the survivors respond to these types of hate crimes? And you know what? Actually, let me back up a second. Let's start with what type of hate crimes we're talking about. When you talk to these folks, how do these hate crimes happen?
So in American Hate, Survivors Speak Out, I document and chronicle the stories of people targeted by hate violence in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election and under the Trump administration. So there are stories of vicious cyber trolling, stories of arson and vandalism of houses of worship, and stories of people who have been assaulted and lost loved ones to hate crimes.
One of the things that I often hear about the house of worship vandalism from people who tend to be dismissive of the rise of hate crimes or perhaps the prevalence or the fear of them is that these are often teenagers playing pranks. These are kids who don't know what they're doing. Did your reporting in this book bear any of that out, that much of this is just pranks somehow gone awry?
Actually, the exact opposite. So in my book, I include two examples of mosques that have been vandalized, and both of them actually relate to presidential rhetoric and policies. So in December 2015, Donald Trump on the campaign trail said he wanted to ban Muslims from entering the United States. That very same day, someone left a pig's head outside the Al-Aqsa Islamic Society Mosque in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Fast forward. January 2017, in one of his first acts as president, Donald Trump signed the travel ban, banning Muslims and refugees from entering the United States. Mm. That same night, a mosque in Victoria, Texas is burned to the ground. Both spokespeople for those two mosques, Marwan Crady and Shahid Hashmi, talk about those crimes in my book.
Is it your contention that these, we've heard this from other experts as well, but that the rhetoric of the president and the president's actions are somehow tied to this? Is that what you believe? And does your research bear that out?
Look, hate pre-existed Donald Trump. Hate will endure after Donald Trump. But he has exercised the worst form of bully pulpit. Through his rhetoric, policies, and appointments, he has incited and emboldened hate across this country. There have literally been thousands of incidents of hate in America where the suspect has specifically mentioned Donald Trump or his policies. And just on an intuitive basis, if the president is going to ban Muslims and refugees, separate and cage immigrant families, roll back protections for transgender students, it puts a target on our collective back.
And again, I want to make this very clear to our audience. I'm not being an apologist for the president or carrying the president's water. I do just want to note that he and his allies say that he's oftentimes trying to restore specific American values. Of course, people often note that those values may indeed and often do benefit folks folks who are white. We're going to be joined now by Rami Jabara. She is the brother of Khalid Jabara, who was killed again before President Trump was elected in 2016. She joins us on the phone. He joins us on the phone. Rami, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by Karen Sakata, who is a Karen was not able to make it, so we'll forget about that. Rami, let's talk a little bit about your brother. Tell us a little bit about who he was and what happened to him.
Well, our brother, Khalid, was he was my older brother. He was the middle child. A huge heart, entertaining as can be. You know, he was the type that walked into a room and everybody's just drawn to him. Good looks and also just very funny. Everybody called him the funny one because about most of his jokes are derived from his own, you know, his original kind of jokester mind. Mm. It's just, you know, we're so sad to lose somebody like, you know, our brother. He was just so unique and so many people loved him. And it's just been tough, of course.
The folks who haven't heard about this, tell us a little bit about what happened to him without, you know, of course, glorifying it. And also tell us that what the aftermath of that was like for you and your family.
Right. So we had next door to my parents in Tulsa, Oklahoma, basically a nuisance neighbor. That's the way it kind of started. But later, this person's acts and conduct kind of intensified, started with just some yelling and screaming towards us. Our family is Lebanese. We come from Lebanon, and he knew that, and he started with, like, dirty Arabs or, you know, filthy Muslims this or that.
Let me jump in there just real quick, because when that first started, and I think this is important, when that first started, how did your family respond? Did they confront it, or did they try and ignore it and hope it would end?
At first, yeah, it was more of a try and ignore, and this guy just, you know, he maybe lost a few brain, I don't know, just a kind of a weird, strange guy that lives next door, just kind of ignore and go about our day. Then he started doing it to people coming over. He would do it to other neighbors, too, a Colombian guy down the street. Just, you know, he would pick and choose based on the way I think people looked or, you know, we have an African-American friend that helps our family with their catering business. He yelled at him a lot of derogatory names, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So we eventually got a protective order against him because, you know, it got to a point where we did not want him, you know, approaching or talking to or yelling at my mom, my dad, anybody that would come to our house. You know, we have a big Lebanese family. There's always people coming and going. So we got that in place, And in 2000, I guess it was March 2015, he violated it for the first time, you know, where we had the order in place and the police could actually take action because of the protective order. And then later that year, you know, on the first violation that he had, he bonded out immediately, right? Then later that year, while he was about to go to trial on that first violation, he ran over my mother in September of 2015 and put her in the ICU for about 2 weeks. So that obviously at that point, we knew that we were dealing with somebody that was very hateful and violent. And
Is your mother okay now, Rami?
She is. She's recovered pretty much. She still has some issues with her leg when she walks, but she's more or less, thank God, I'd say about 90% back to her health. After about a few months of you know, in the hospital and in rehab, so thank God she is doing okay. And so just to continue that. So he ran over my mother. He was charged with an assault and battery with a deadly weapon right after that. And he and the judge knew that he, this guy was the same guy that we had the protective order against. So, of course, he said, we're not going to give you bail. We're not going to let you bond out because you obviously do not like your neighbors, in a nice way of saying it. So he was without bail for about 8 months. And then when his case got moved over to the higher criminal court about to get a trial, that judge bonded him out, not knowing the history. There was kind of like a drop the ball in communication. So he actually bonded out, facing trial on the first violation of protective order, and then on the second, which was hitting my mom, almost killing her, bonded out in the summer of 2016. And then 2 months later, he shot and killed my brother in front of it, my parents' house.
So he was allowed to keep his gun while he was...
Well, he lived with another man, and I believe there was a gun in the house, or the other man had a firearm of some kind. I don't know who had actual possession of the gun. I believe it was the other man. So, of course, he got a hold of it, and, you know, did the most terrible thing. And this whole time we were really, you know, we were trying to get my parents to move. At that time, my dad is very frail health-wise. So it's just very difficult to move. And, of course, again, we got that call and my brother was killed.
I'm really sorry to hear that. Rami, I want you to stay with us because, you know, Arjun, as I listen to this, I've covered a lot of white nationalism that has risen, a lot of alt-right and right-wing fringe groups, right-wing militias during my course as a reporter. And there are many red flags I'm hearing in Rami's story along the way, the first being that oftentimes when people begin to bully folks, if they're not met with opposition right off the bat, they continue to do this. Is this something you found while you were reporting out your book, American Hate?
Absolutely. And when I heard the story of Khala Jibara, I knew that I had to include the family story in the book, which is why I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I met with Rami, Victoria, and Haifa Jibara. And their story is so tragic because every institution in this country failed the Jibara family, whether it was the prosecutor's office, whether it was the judge, whether it was the police the day that Khalid was murdered. In this case, there were so many warning signs. The neighbor harassed and terrorized the family, committed a violent crime against Haifa Jibara, and yet was still allowed to post bond and then murder Khalid, you know, months later on their front doorstep. And in many cases, I did find, just like I did with the Jibaras, that there were warning signs and that folks didn't make the interventions that were necessary. And often it spiraled into something far worse than we could have imagined.
Rami, as we, you know, bring this story to a close, I want to know how your family's doing now and basically how you kept on knowing that at every step, it seems, you know, either the system or someone else failed, resulting in both, you know, a very hard injury for your mother and the death of your brother.
Right. So, you know, we're very fortunate to have a very, you know, strong community around us between our immediate neighbors in the neighborhood, our church community. We're Orthodox Christian, the greater Lebanese community, the Jewish and Muslim communities really all came together. And honestly, the support was just, you couldn't even imagine how many people came out to the vigil that we had and the services. And one really nice thing that my niece, that's my sister's daughter, Layla's school, put together, she goes to school at a local synagogue, and they put together a library, kind of like a social justice, promoting peace and educating those students with like a children's library. Mm-hmm. So that's been something that's really, you know, just a beautiful thing. Our brother really connected the kids. They were always entertained by him and his goofiness. He could do many of the Muppets characters and many of the, you know, any kind of character you would tell him, he could figure out the voice. Hmm. So kids just really, you know, enjoyed his presence. But so, you know, it's definitely been a challenge. The trial was earlier this year, and the defendant was convicted on all charges. He got the maximum sentence, which, of course, you know, the DA did its job there. And the defendant actually passed away a few months ago. So he, you know, he was going to serve a life sentence, but he died in jail just recently. Hmm. Yeah, to your other point, as far as I think you were asking about police, or I'm not really
well, just sure just process. Yeah, I mean, the thing I hear time and time again is that this always starts off as like what could be described as, you know, kind of low-key harassment.
Right.
That in, it's almost like the waters are tested. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for anyone who is going through something similar where it's starting off as a harassment or vandalism claim. What would you do differently how the outcome turned?
Well, you know, I think everybody should take something like this very serious, especially when somebody uses rhetoric that's, you know, demeaning towards somebody's ethnicity or their religion. That those seem to follow a pattern of, you know, continued aggression that does only intensify. So act quickly with a protective order. Make your other neighbors aware that there's somebody there that, you know, is spewing hateful words. And as far as like law enforcement, you know, they need to be extra aware, pay attention to those, because those are serious warning signs and red flags. Whenever there's a protective order in place and it's a neighbor relationship, why is that in place? Is it about a fence line, or is it about, like, you know,
something deeper? Right.
Yeah. Like, like, you know, a dirty Arab or something, because, you know, that can be very serious, especially in the environment we're in. So those are all, and as Arjun said, the warning flags in our case were so bright and clear, and it's like the system couldn't put it all together. They couldn't connect the dots, and that continues to happen every day, unfortunately. And I think, you know, we just need to do, I don't know, there's a lot of technology out there that could maybe bridge that gap, but
something clearly has to be done differently, because we're seeing this increase in hate crimes. Rami Jabara joining us on the phone. Rami, I want to thank you so much, and I wish the best to your family this Thanksgiving holiday. I know it's going to be hard to have that voice of humor and levity missing from you. The best of luck to you, Rami.
Right. Thank you so much. Thank you.
We also know that the numbers, Arjun, might be a little or a lot actually underreported, because you know, the police, they have the option to report this as a hate crime. And a lot of people who endure these hate attacks don't, the first thing they do is not go to police or try and get a court order. They, essentially, you know, try and hope that this will go away in some regard.
Absolutely. So according to the FBI, there was roughly 7,000 hate crimes committed in the year 2017. But if you look at a self-reporting mechanism like the National Crime Victimization Survey, the total number of hate crimes is closer to 250,000. So why the gap? Why the gap between 7,000 and 250,000? It's because, as you rightly point out, the FBI doesn't require law enforcement to report. It's only voluntary. So most police departments don't bother reporting. And when they do, they often lie and report zero hate crimes. That understates the problem of hate violence. It diminishes the threat of white supremacy. And it puts vulnerable communities at even greater risk.
Is it possible that the police aren't lying about it, but many might not recognize it? Some might not understand it for what it is?
In some cases, I think that's true. In other cases, I just don't buy it. And I say that because advocates have been raising the flag and alarm bells about this issue for so long, and yet police aren't acting. So just so listeners have a sense of how egregious this report was, the murder of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville isn't reflected in the 2017 FBI report. The murder of Srinivas Kuchibhotla in Olathe, Kansas, is not reflected. Mm. And the tragedy that happened on the Portland MAX train in May of 2017.
That wasn't listed as a hate crime?
No, it's not reflected in the data. Neither of those four instances are reflected in the 2017 FBI report, which is why I tell people that is not a report that we can rely on. Well, because, again, it really underestimates the threat of hate violence.
I want to make it clear that the report is a baseline. I am actually flabbergasted. I lived in Portland. I followed the Portland, the TriMet stabbing very closely. I mean, to have that not listed as a hate crime just seems beyond. We were going to be joined by Karen Sakata of the Contra Costa County Superintendent of Schools. She was going to talk about some of the solutions of this, and I'm sorry we weren't able to get to her. But just, Arjun, as we bring this conversation to a close, one thing I've noticed is that when schools and others try to stop these hate crimes, they're often attacked. What would you say to schools who are on the fence about trying to stop them at the ground level in the schools with about 30 seconds to go?
It goes to a point you made earlier, and that is that hate is like a pyramid. It starts with exclusion, then it escalates into bullying, then it escalates into threats of violence, to violence, and then finally genocide. Meaning, we have to start with exclusion. We have to start with the soft bullying, because if we don't treat hate from the time of inception, it is likely to spiral into something so much worse.
Arjun Sethi is the author of American Hate, Survivors Speak Out. Arjun, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.